Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spratnak. I imagine that progressives across the nation are feeling a bit more chipper after President Obama's inaugural address on Monday. And more about that at the end of this program. The crises that have nearly everyone's attention these days are climate change and our battered, patched up, still very skewed and rigged economy. Of course, those two crises are inherently interrelated. I saw an article in the New York Times last Sunday on 10 things we need to do to achieve a real recovery from the financial collapse. It was by Alan Blinder, a professor of economics at Princeton and a former vice chair of the Federal Reserve. And he makes a lot of good points, which I'll share. But listen here for what's missing, for the huge dimension that's missing when we think about changing business as usual in light of the global climate crisis and the growing epidemic fallout from environmental toxins in and around us. Seems like every week they're linked to another disease or detrimental health condition. Well, Professor Blinder started out his op-ed piece, actually, with his sense of where things stand now. He said, unrepentant financiers whine about excessive regulation and pay lobbyists to battle every step toward reform. Conservatives bemoan big government and yearn to return to laissez-faire deregulation. Higher international standards for bank capital and liquidity have been delayed. So you can see from that orientation, he's got his head on straight and cares about the common good of the entire society, not just the financiers. So his first suggestion of what needs to be done is remember that people forget. And here he cites the economist Hyman Minsky. You might remember I mentioned him a few weeks ago when Peter Warshall was on talking about 20-year cycles. They decided to build that New Mexico community-based economics project on 20-year cycles, thinking about it that way. And I said, oh, yeah, Professor Minsky, when he did a study of the history of the U.S. economy, concluded that every 20 years or so, the banks put a torch to the economy. So here, Alan Blinder is citing Minsky as pointing out that it's normal for speculative markets to go to extremes. That's because people forget what the last one was like. And when those speculative bubbles collapse, as they always do, people are always surprised. So that was his first point. Remember that people forget. So there need to be safeguards against this happening. And the next one, do not rely on self-regulation, which is a cruel oxymoron when it comes to financial markets. Boy, that's the truth. Well, those corrupt ratings on those rotten securitized mortgages, still hasn't been fixed, has it? The next one, honor the shareholders. Boards of public corporations, he says, are supposed to protect the interest of the shareholders partly by monitoring the behavior of top executives who are employees, not emperors. And the next one, he says, elevate the importance in every company of risk management analysis. Too many CEOs let their subordinates run roughshod over the risk managers. And he says, but the Federal Reserve and other regulators are now watching that and mustn't let up. And then he says, you know, they should be allowed to use less leverage. Leverage, which he says is essentially just over-borrowing, was used by overpaid investment geniuses to manufacture extraordinary returns out of ordinary investments. Well, that led to the bank's near-death experiences, as he calls it. And then he talks about keep it simple, stupid. Yeah, modern finance profits from complexity because befuddled customers are more profitable ones. But do all those fancy financial instruments actually do the economy any good? Who needs credit default swaps on collateralized debt obligations and other such concoctions? Yeah, why are they allowed since they caused such a catastrophe? In part, they caused it. And then he says standardized derivatives, trade them on open exchanges transparently. But there's, of course, a lot of fighting about that to keep them hidden out of the sunshine, so to speak. And then he says keep everything on the balance sheet. You know, before the crash, a lot of companies were moving debt off the balance sheet, and their CEOs didn't even realize that or weren't paying attention. It was certainly their job. So he points out that Dodd-Frank specifies that capital requirements shall take into account any off-balance sheet activities of the company, including overborrowing and huge debt. And then he says, fix perverse compensation, offering traders monumental rewards for success, but a mere slap on the wrist for failure, which is often part of a scam, encourages them to take excessive risks. And the last one he advises, what we learned in the financial crisis was that failure to protect unsophisticated consumers from financial predators can undermine the entire economy. That surprising lesson mustn't be forgotten. He says the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau should institutionalize it. And that new bureau, of course, was the invention, the brainchild of Senator Elizabeth Warren. So, these are all good suggestions, Professor Blinder, and I wish they were thoroughly accepted in Washington these days, including accepted by Mary Jo White, the prosecuting attorney who was chosen today by President Obama to be the new head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC. But we're going to hear from someone now who steps it up to a consideration of the larger context of all this. Hang on. My guest today is Hazel Henderson. She's the founder of Ethical Markets Media Company and is the creator and co-executive producer of its TV series. She's an internationally known futurist and an evolutionary economist, as well as a consultant on sustainable development and transforming finance. She's the author of 8 books, including most recently, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, which I highly recommend. In addition, she co-edited a book called The United Nations, Policy and Financing Alternatives. She's also a syndicated columnist. Her editorials appear in 200 newspapers and in 27 languages. Her television series, Ethical Markets, is seen on many public television stations. In 2007, she was elected a fellow to Britain's Royal Society of Arts, which was founded in 1754. In 2010, 2012, 2013, she has been honored as one of the top 100 thought leaders in trustworthy business behavior by Trust Across America. In 2012, she was named to the Post Growth Institute Enrich list. They have parenthesis EN, close parenthesis, and then rich, their Enrich list, as a top 100 luminary inspiring global prosperity beyond economic wealth. She was also honored for her lifetime achievement with the award for natural law and order from the Maharishi University School of Management. Hazel Henderson, in addition, received the award for outstanding contribution to development of environmental, social, governance, and investing, which is an award sponsored by Reuters and administered by the organization called TBLI Europe, an international institute located in the Netherlands. And the initials in its title stand for the triple bottom line. She leads the Transforming Finance Initiative, created the Green Transition Scoreboard, co-developed with Calvert Investments the GDP Alternative, now renamed the Ethical Markets Quality of Life Indicators, and she co-organized the Beyond GDP Conference for the European Commission. In preparation for and subsequent to that European Commission conference, she has funded 3 Beyond GDP surveys. Let me tell you, folks, there are a few words at one spot on the website, ethicalmarkets.com, that I think say it all. 40 years of foresight, insight, and integrity. Mm-hmm. You betcha. That is Hazel Henderson. She's the green queen of greening finance and our economies. Mm-hmm. Hazel Henderson, welcome to All Together Now.
Oh, Charlene, thank you, and thank you for that lovely, wonderful introduction.
Oh, so
wow.
Deserved. Well, actually, I might have said welcome back to All Together Now, because I had you on as one of the very first guests on this program. That was for the Earth Day show last April.
Yeah.
And there's so much going on regarding the economy today that I keep thinking almost every time I open the paper, I wonder what Hazel thinks about all this.
Well, you
so
know,
I'd like to begin by asking, what is your sense of what's happening now with regard to the post-crash economic recovery, not just in the stock market? And at this point, January 24th, 2013, what seems to you to be encouraging and what's worrisome?
Well, first of all, that list you read from the ex-Fed member, I would agree pretty much with that whole list, and I would agree with you that, you know, it's going to be a real fight to get any of those things actually done, because all of those financial lobbyists are still there in Washington, and they still fund our politicians. And the thing that he couldn't really say, but which I say every time I get a chance, is that the overall issue is that we have to downsize finance.
Mm-hmm.
If finance is the ultimate bubble, it's the mother of all bubbles. You know, you cannot have...
And it's grown so much.
That's
in
right.
In a proportion of our economy. Yeah,
yeah. You know, you can't have a healthy Main Street, real, on-the-ground economy if it's dominated by a financial system which basically is extracting value from it, which
right.
is actually what's happening. You know, instead of the financial community serving Main Street, it's turned out to be the other way around.
Yeah.
And so that downsizing, I'm happy to say, is beginning to be addressed by something that I have been pushing for about 15 years, and that is a financial transaction tax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have taxes. Even if we go have a cup of coffee somewhere, we pay the equivalent of some kind of sales tax.
Mm-hmm.
And so all financial transactions ought to have a small, you know, below 1% tax. And this would begin to downsize this sort of obsessional trading.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a wonderful book that came out last year called Between the Hour Between Dog and Wolf. And this was an economist who had gone back to Cambridge University and gotten a degree in biology at the urging of a woman who is a professor at Rockefeller University. And she told him that she thought that the trading community on stock exchanges around the world were actually a clinical population. And should be studied that way. And so this fellow did do that. And he went to Canary Wharf in London and took cheek swabs of all of the traders and found, they had this incredibly elevated testosterone levels.
Uh-huh.
And that relates to excessive risk-taking.
Uh-huh.
So he began to connect the dots. And this whole book is about the hormonal cycles that these traders who are trading thousands of securities literally every time, every second, not minute, second, and this high frequency trading. And so that book, I know you'd love it, Charlene. And it gets much deeper into the analysis than any ex-Fed chairman, however good, you know, could possibly do. So the good news I found in the last week, let's say, is 11 countries now of the European Union have agreed to have a financial transaction tax. And there are financial transaction taxes in other countries already. And so we are beginning to get a handle on that necessary downsizing. And the other thing, which is really very exciting to me, because of the fact that we do this green transition scoreboard, and I'm just about to update it. And our hypothesis has been that if there is at least $1 trillion a year of private investment in green sectors around the world, and we've been tracking this since 2007, and our current number is 3.6 trillion. And the of all people, the Economic Forum that's just meeting there in Davos, Switzerland right now, came out with a report yesterday. And what they did was to put our number, you see, it sounds really big, oh my God, you know, $1 trillion a year. And we are saying, you know, if this keeps up, $1 trillion a year keeps up for between now and 2020, we, the human family, will have entered the solar age. We will have left the fossil fuel world and entered the solar age because we will have ramped up the solar, wind, energy efficiency, geothermal, all the renewables so that they are cheaper than coal and oil and nuclear.
But it also said we'll be dragging along the fossil fuel age with us because we have to build all these coastal protections now against the global climate crisis that we wouldn't have had to spend on had we done this earlier.
Oh, yeah, it would have been good. But here is the context that, that gave me such a lift today, that we have to remember the context is that the investment required, which is the business as usual investment that the world makes in telecoms, power, transport, buildings, industry, you know, all of those sectors, the big sector, stands at $5 trillion per year between now and 2020. So all we're doing is to say shift some of it away from the business as usual, you know, polluting stuff, to the green stuff, and we're home free.
That's right.
So, you know, it, that just helps to illustrate that it's totally a paradigm problem. And the fact that we have to retrain all the asset managers, you know, they have to forget everything they were taught at the Harvard Business School about finance and, you know, modern portfolio theory and all of that kind of stuff.
And nature as a mere externality.
That's right, and nature as an externality. And so the other part of the good news is that there are now universities beginning to teach this. Like St. Andrews University in Scotland had a course for retraining asset managers last summer. So, you know, that's what made me feel good today.
Great. Wow. Well, since our last conversation, a lot has really changed in some of the areas we were talking about, and, you know, then not nearly enough changes happen in others, but regarding climate change, I think it's clear now that a whole lot of people take it more seriously than last spring because of the extreme weather events in the second half of last year.
And the fact that the president got up and actually spoke the words, it is inaugural, and we've all kind of come out
really
of denial.
Yeah, ready to grab at straws.
And yet, you know, the point that we've always made at the, with our Green Transition Scoreboard is that the win-win here between the financial system and the economy and climate change is simply that everybody knows now, and this is another thing that this report from the World Economic Forum agreed to, the only way, they say, we agree of course, to satisfy the needs of today's population is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and invest in the transition to the green economy. And so what we've been saying all of this time, you know, is why, while all of the climate summits have been so contentious and everybody arguing about who's to blame, you know, the tier one countries and the tier two countries and all that, you know, that basically what they left laying on the table was that everybody has to move to a low carbon economy.
Right.
And that's the answer. And so why the heck don't we just get on with it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that report, you know, for the World Economic Forum, it did say we need everyone to be moving in the same direction. It said some people in the private sector are still moving the opposite way and continuing to worsen the problem when many people are seeing the direction we all need to go together.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting because a group I work with in Britain called the Carbon Tracker, I'm sure you know their stuff, but they came out with a study last year looking at the FTSE 100, you know, that's the stock exchange in London, and they noticed that 40% of the companies on that FTSE 100 are invested in coal and oil, which can never be lifted out of the ground without cooking the planet.
Yeah.
So what we did, a group of us got together and we wrote letters to the president of the bank, the governor of the Bank of England, and the governor of the European Central Bank, and we said that these assets are basically toxic assets. They are subprime, and they have to be written down by at least $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, this created a tremendous furor, but it's part of the of this retraining that has to happen, you see, with all these asset managers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's beginning from the outside, you know, that people are just stressing them in such a way that they're bound to answer now.
Yeah.
At least they have to give us an answer.
Yeah. Well, I saw that Bill McKibben used their figure, the carbon tracking people, for this almost 2,800 gigatons of carbon-based fuel that are built into their books, as you say. But I didn't realize this group had just directly said to them, look, you have to write some of this down now.
Oh, yeah.
So that's great to hear.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, when I looked at your website, I was so delighted to see that since we last spoke, you've launched this extremely interesting statement called Transforming Finance. And the reason, I know you'll understand why I was so happy to see that, is, you know, in different areas, you and I have both been working for 40 years to get an eco-social analysis and vision put widely into the culture. It's not going to work anymore to look at one half or the other half without putting it together.
Right.
And no one does that better than you do when it comes to thinking about money, finance, the economy. So the full title of this statement is Transforming Finance Based on Ethics and Life's Principles. And you launched it last June 27th, and since then a lot of leaders in various fields and countries have signed on to it, I see. So to orient the listeners, I'll just start here by reading a little bit of the introductory paragraph of the Ethical Market Statement, Transforming Finance. And it opens by saying, we, the signers, hold this biological truth to be self-evident, that the human species is interdependent with all other life forms on planet Earth. Therefore, human societies, cultures, values, and belief systems that are informed by and modeled on the following of life's principles, which are strategies universal to all organisms, should provide the basis for all production and exchange of goods, community structures, and services. This includes the design of monetary systems, investments, banking, financing, bartering, reciprocal exchange, payments, crowdfunding, compensation, and unpaid gifting, sharing, cooperatives, reproduction of future generations, provision of public goods, infrastructure, collective health, education, and life-supporting services. Well, hallelujah. Self-evident, yeah.
Oh, well, you know.
I just want to say, well, I'm going to ask you to get into this by just stating what your overall goal is with the statement and then getting right into the first one. But again, just to frame it, I have a whole chapter in Relational Reality on this thinking, this recognition of interrelatedness changing our economy, especially at the grassroots level. But you've really just advanced the conversation so much with this statement. I'm just delighted. So what are your overall goals, first of all, in making this and launching it?
Well, you know, the whole idea, which has, you know, been a consuming passion of mine for as long as it has you, Charlene, was sort of re-educating economists and financiers about the realities of the natural world. And so I thought, oh, my God, here I am, you know, I've written 8 books, and, you know, you've written all these wonderful books. And somehow now we have to engage with these people. So I thought, how do you actually engage with asset managers and financial people? And I've been somewhat successful with that, you know, with the work I did with the Calvert Group.
Uh-huh.
But what's necessary now, and this is what has now emerged from this statement, is that we now have what you can crassly call an intellectual product, i.e., we have a manual now, a 50-page manual with all of the footnotes, called the Principles of Ethical Biomimicry Finance, trademarked. And what we are going to do, we're beginning this right now, is
now, let's say we explain to people who we is with
ethical
the addition
markets,
of biomimicry.
Yeah, Ethical Markets Media and the Biomimicry Institute, founded by Janine Benyus, who is our partner on this. But we'll have to do all the heavy lifting because we're the ones that relate to the financial community. They much more relate to the design community.
Right.
And so, basically, we are now out there actually engaging our traditional financiers and asset managers and investors and say, if you want to learn this new method of investing, which you're going to have to know about in the next few years because you'll be, you know, it will be demanded of you to know about it, here we have the manual where you can learn all about this. But guess what? We are going to license it to you, and you have to pay us a lot of money because financial people don't value anything unless they have to pay a lot of money for it.
Oh, boy.
And so we are a social enterprise. We are not yet in the black ourselves, even though, you know, we are beginning, our business model is licensing our TV shows and my books and all of that kind of thing. But basically, these principles, we think, will really put us over the top at the same time that they will actually begin the job of re-educating all the asset managers. So that's the purpose of this thing. You know, it's we decided it wasn't any good to just give radio interviews and just write books, and important as those things are, you have to figure out how to engage.
That's right.
And
you jump in there as a valued consultant that they really need, and boy, do they need you. Well, we're going to pause right here for the break. I'm speaking with my guest, Hazel Henderson. This is All Together Now. I'm Charlene Spretnak. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Hazel Henderson, author of Ethical Markets. Her website address is ethicalmarkets.com. So, Hazel, we're talking about this new statement, Transforming Finance, that a lot of people have signed on to since you launched it. And there are 9 points to it, and I wonder if you could go through and hit the high spots here for the listeners. I'm particularly taken by the fact that you point out economic systems are human systems, so they're emergent properties. They come out of this dynamic mix of life, and therefore we can view them as not being static, and we can start thinking about, well, what's viable in these systems that we would design or change? So
Yes, well, that's kind of point number seven, but I'll start there.
Yeah, let's start with, well, you can start with one. It's my favorite.
It's funny because, you see, we started where we thought that the economics and the financial community would be.
That's right.
You know, which is number one,
uh-huh.
where we really wanted them to understand that what is currently called economics and finance is actually sort of embedded in human societies and cultural values, and they
that's
in turn
sure.
are embedded in planetary ecosystems, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
And so then we kind of work up to that that number seven, you know, which is, okay, now are you ready to kind of see
yeah.
that what we term as economies and financial systems are simply emergent properties from complex adaptive systems.
Mm-hmm.
And, you
because
know...
Because they're fooled in this mechanistic way, compartmentalized thinking, the economic system just sort of, you know, sprang on its own, and it's
yeah.
above nature, and it's not connected to anything else, those are
exactly.
externalities. So, yeah, even just stating that in your opening paragraph there, as you say, does move the marbles around.
Oh, it has done quite a lot. And the whole idea that, you know, that our societies, you know, are downloads, you know, from these kind of cultural DNA codes that we all carry in our heads, and, you know, they actually result in physical forms and current cultural artifacts like skyscrapers and computers, you know, and nuclear power plants, as well as the sort of similar forms that emerge from the world's spiritual traditions like cathedrals and books and, you know, monasteries.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what we were trying to do, you know, is to get them away from that sort of Cartesian mentality. And, you know, and kind of what we wanted to say is that we're rejoicing in the fact that we humans, so many of us, are evolving now toward this much more aware and expansive view of the planet that we live on, you know. And the life's principles, which Janine Benyus developed, and, you know, I've known Janine for years, and I have been giving her book that came out in 1997,
mm-hmm.
Biomimicry, I've been giving that away as gifts for years.
Mm-hmm.
But her principles basically are that all life forms evolve in order to survive. They are resource and material and energy efficient to the max.
Mm-hmm.
They adapt to changing conditions.
Uh-huh.
They integrate development with their growth, and they are locally attuned and responsive. They fit in and integrate with their surrounding environment. And this one is very relevant right now to many of the companies that we're looking at, use life-friendly chemistry. In other words, chemistry that isn't based on what Janine calls heat, beat, and treat. You know, it's
right.
all done at room temperature. The
uh-huh.
solvent is mostly water. You know, this is the way nature does things.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, it doesn't use anything from the really high end of the periodic table. It mostly uses the first elements in the first five elements in the periodic table, you know, which is carbon and oxygen and nitrogen, etc. And nature would never use uranium or any of these heavy metals from, you know, the very last kind of elements. And this, you know, relates like to lithium. I mean, suddenly everybody's rushing around, you know, doing lithium batteries. I think they're going to be transient because nature wouldn't use lithium. So this is a way of looking at the world which finances really need to understand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
especially
they're going to keep investing in toxic assets.
Yeah, even since you released the statement on June 27th, there have been more and more breaking stories of what I call the relational shift all these discoveries about how dynamically interrelated the physical world, including humans, really is.
Oh, yeah.
And I've mentioned before that article that was in the New Yorker on October 22nd about the entire field of microbiology is in the middle of a big transition right now off the mechanistic model onto the relational model.
Absolutely.
Of understanding how bacteria really function in the body and in nature. So so many scientists have said, you know, we're on the verge of a big redesign of science, and economics is going to have to incorporate these truths because their system is built on old mechanistic assumptions.
Exactly. And I mean, if you look at the way even doctors now are going to have to be completely retrained.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
The human beings are actually biomes. And
that's right.
Most of microbiome within the human body is not our intrinsic DNA. About 90% of it is the DNA of bacteria, without which we couldn't live.
Yeah,
bacteria in our gut. And so if you were a doctor and you were trained at Harvard Medical School, you're gonna have to go back to school as well. Not just the financiers are going to have to go back to school.
Exactly.
Because, you know, I mean, it's a totally different way.
Well, you make
way.
It easy for them because you show, you know, you don't have to figure out on your own. Here's the bridge between that and this that your area is. That's why I think it's just invaluable at this moment in history.
I hope so. And, you know, it's really interesting because some of the wonderful friends that we have who tend to be brilliant people, mostly men, who've dropped out of Wall Street, and one of them had studied this thing. He's one of my, I mean, I'm on his advisory board, you know, and he's on mine. And he has studied this thing, like, for months and saying, God, I don't know if I can really sign this. You know, especially number two, where we said, you know, money, markets, and finance are useful human inventions and as such are good servants of evolutionary purposes but can be bad masters. Mm-hmm. And then we say that money has no analog in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Nature operates on direct exchange, you know, barter of information, material, and services.
Mm-hmm.
And the only circulatory system that nature uses, not money, it's like water and the carbon cycle and the nitrogen cycle. So there are cycling mechanisms in nature, but they don't have anything to do with money. And this hung this guy up for the long
time. Oh, yeah.
And then suddenly he emailed and he says, oh, my God. Okay, I'm signing it. And so, you know, we have to understand, you know, what a huge investment, I mean, the intellectual investment that these guys, and they are mostly guys.
It's a deep shift.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of part of your identity.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's tough. It's really tough.
Yeah.
And so, on the other hand, it's very freeing.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's almost like suddenly going on the magical mystery tour, you know.
Yeah, well, it's coming out of the artificial into life, you know, get in sync with the life processes, so it's got to be healthy.
Yes, exactly. And there is a certain joy that you know, we've been holding these meetings here, you see, for 3 years on this transforming finance with all these dropouts from Wall Street. And at the end of the day, you see, it's all very freeing and exciting and fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, oh, my God, I get to think all of these new thoughts.
Right, right.
You know, and I see a bigger picture.
Yeah, terrific, terrific. You're opening it up for them.
Yeah, they love it. You know, we all end up hugging and, you know, and our mantra is always the wealth is in the network.
Uh-huh.
You know, money is not wealth.
Uh-huh.
You know.
The wealth is in the network. That was nature for you.
Wealth is in the network.
Well, I'd like to tell people a bit about these three other current projects that are going on at Ethical Markets. We just have about 8 or 9 minutes left, but can you tell us about that? You've mentioned the Green Transition Scoreboard. What's that
yes,
now?
Oh, yes. I mean, and the reason I started that at just running up to the Copenhagen UN Climate Conference, and I knew that was going to be a train wreck. Oh, my God, you could to see it. All the bureaucrats were all, you know, getting in, you know, instructions from their government, pat, you know, we can't raise our sights, no bigger targets and all
this. Nothing.
And, you know, and so I started the Green Transition Scoreboard at that time just to try to say, look, guess what? None of us have a dog in this fight. We can all agree that what we need to do is to move to low-carbon economies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and why can't we stop fighting and just begin looking at how the best way to do this? And what I'm happiest about is that since we've been putting this out, you know, we now are at $3.6 trillion. And we've been using a model. Some Australian friends of ours did this model called Climate Solutions 2. And we believe every word of it. And it more or less said, if you looked at all of these different ways humans get their energy, that if we could just keep on with $1 trillion going in every year, which has been, you know, regularly, we can accelerate this transition because we're going to bring all of these solar, wind, and all the other renewables to scale and put the other fossil fuel era energy sources out of business because it'll be cheaper. And so basically, you know, we update it twice a year. And what's interesting to me is that it has served as a forcing function. Our company is a member of a group called the United Nations Principles of Responsible Investing. And these are mostly worldwide pension funds, endowments, you know, charitable institutions. And altogether, they represent $33 trillion, with a T, of assets under management. So we use this Green Transition Scoreboard to say to them, look, you can see now all of these companies who are making this transition. And we are asking you to shift just 10% of your assets, of that $33 trillion, from fossil fuels and nuclear power into the green, into energy efficiency, wind, solar, and all of these other technologies. And this has been a forcing function, because no one wants to admit that a little pipsqueak organization like ours has pushed them, but we know we have. And another consulting firm came along, very well-known, the Mercer, a international consulting firm, when we produced our update last year and, you know, made this whole pitch, come on, shift 10% of your assets to renewables. And their report said, no, 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 40%.
Oh.
And they said that half of that should be to risk assessment of climate change and, you know, environmental risk factors, but the other half would be to take opportunities in growing the green economy. So, and I know that this report that just came out that I started telling you about at the beginning from the World Economic Forum, this I know was driven by our work. And you know, that they are actually agreeing chapter and verse.
Terrific.
Everything we're putting out, but of course we won't get any credit, but that's okay, you know. And then the other thing we are doing is, you know, my passion in an alternative to GDP.
Yeah.
And that's now pretty much recognized. And we have the third of our surveys, which we do with GlobeScan in London, in 11 countries. And it's in the field right now. And we know, because of the prior two that we've done, that if you ask ordinary people which of two statements they most agree with, and this is called the debate format, and you say, which of these two statements do you most agree with? That is that the progress of a society is best measured by money measurements, including the gross national product, and that this is by far the best way, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. And the second is that it's very important to go beyond money and to include all of the available statistics on progress in, toward health, education, poverty gaps, environmental quality. And of course, what happens is every time we do this in every country, north, south, east, and west, you get like 80% majorities. Uh-huh. And people say, duh, you know, well, of course. They like the second,
but not the economists yet, although that's changing. Well, now, we have just about a minute. I'm really interested. I'd like you to say just a bit about what this Ethic Mark Awards for advertising
that uplifts the human spirit and society is. Yeah, basically, I started that in 2004 with a bequest I got from an English aunt of mine. And now we just gave our sixth annual award in London at the Sustainable Brand Conference, and I come into these things, you know, on the big screen now because I don't really like to travel anymore. Uh-huh. And basically, there were 450 corporate executives, and they just loved it because I was talking about the new role for advertising, which is beyond selling, you know, materialistic consumption, and instead helping people to more satisfying personal growth and development, and moving toward more sustainable societies. And anyway, so I got the most wonderful feedback from this. And we're really now going global with this. You know, we've got a whole new team of people who've joined our judging panel from many other countries, and this is a new wave of advertising and marketing executives who share this kind of vision. So, you know, this is the first time I think an environmental organization like ours has been able to actually engage the advertising industry.
Uh-huh.
You know, they all of the limits to growth discussions have been pointing to advertising as part of the problem, but they never figured out a way to actually engage with these people.
Yeah.
So that was why we did that.
Yeah. Well, I saw that one example. If people go to ethicalmarkets.com, then they can click on this Ethic Market Awards, and it takes you to the site where the award was given. And the example that plays, that little commercial, was for fair trade products. And the theme was, you know, if you're selecting a gift to give someone, make it a fair trade gift, and it gives twice. You know,
yes,
it gives to the families of the farmers or producers, as well as to your friend. But it was just beautifully done. And I thought a great example. Well, alas, we are out of time, but Hazel, I have learned so much as usual, and I want to thank you so much for coming onto the program.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Charlene. And I'm rooting for this network, the Progressive Radio Network. I think that's totally wonderful.
Ah, so great.
Good luck to you all. I was listening to the commercial coming up for the program tonight, I guess, no, tomorrow on local currencies.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely right on.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot on the weekly schedule that, you know, would be in your ballpark.
Great stuff. Well, keep it up.
Okay, thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. So let's move over to the Arts Corner, and for our poem this week, we have one by Elizabeth Bishop, whom many poets regard as one of the very most accomplished American poets of the last century. This is from the collection entitled Elizabeth Bishop, The Complete Poems, 1927 to 1979. This poem is entitled One Art. The art of losing isn't hard to master. So many things seem filled with the intent to be lost that their loss is no disaster. Lose something every day. Accept the fluster of lost door keys, the hours spent badly. The art of losing isn't hard to master. Then practice losing farther, losing faster, places and names and where it was you meant to travel. None of these will bring disaster. I lost my mother's watch. And look, my last, or next to last, of three loved houses went. The art of losing isn't hard to master. I lost two cities, lovely ones, and vaster, some realms I owned, two rivers, a continent. I miss them, but it wasn't a disaster. Even losing you, the joking voice, a gesture I love, I shan't have lied. It's evident the art of losing's not too hard to master, though it may look like, write it, like disaster. For our song today, well, I'm pretty sure that the listening audience at Progressive Radio Network is feeling downright encouraged by President Obama's second inaugural address 3 days ago. I mean, truly, he hasn't sounded that activist since his first presidential campaign in 2008. And so clear about the role of the federal government in addressing the crises we face as a society. So just to nudge things in the right direction, in case the prez is for real on all he said, we're going to hear the song, originally from a film in 1930, that became the theme song of President Franklin D. Roosevelt's four terms. Too bad I don't have a recording of all the crowds of working-class people and middle-class people across the country who sang this song as FDR's campaign train pulled into the downtown terminal of their city. The novelist Saul Bellow recalled in an article that when he went into his elementary school classroom one day in Chicago, his teacher was singing this song the morning after FDR got reelected one time. Oh yes, that was the period when this country got the Social Security program, unemployment benefits, and public works projects for needed civic construction that helped people survive through the long jobs crisis. Hey, haven't we got one of those right now? Just sing along. Here it is.
Days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together, shout it now. There's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world all about it now. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. So long, sad times. So long, bad times. We are rid of you at last. Howdy, gay times, cloudy, gray times, you are now a thing of the past.
Happy days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together, shout it now, there's no one who can doubt it now. So let's tell the world about it now. Happy days are here again. Your cares and troubles are gone. There'll be no more from now on. Happy days are here again, the skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. happy days are here again. The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. If you'd like to see who the guests will be for the next few weeks, go to my website, charlenespretnak.com, and click on the tab that says Radio. Join me next week when my guests will be Marianne Williamson, talking with us about her big Sister Giant project.